One last thing before we move on to the next item in the news. One of the reasons that I would have had, if I had been in the Florida law enforcement, I would have gone ahead and prosecuted Jameis Winston, is that a week in jail would have been good for him. My employee spent, I don't know if it was 45 days or 2 months or 3 months, but somewhere between 45 days and 3 months in jail. I frankly, it was a while ago. I don't remember the numbers. And he explained it as the most difficult time of his life, but the most important time of his life. He explained jail as revolting. It wasn't the deprivation of freedom. It was being in an open room with some 100 individuals. He said that there was blood, vomit, and feces everywhere. He says if you didn't go in and use the bathroom in the wee hours of the night right after it had been cleaned, like in at 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning, he says you couldn't even walk in there. He said the stench and the disgusting nature of it, you just couldn't even walk in there. He said that drugs were pervasive, that the guards themselves were bribed by the inmates in the jail, and that you're constantly being induced to participate in illegal activity. He just said, all in all, it was the most repulsive, the most just disgusting time of his life. And it was just how in the world am I going to manage this so that, you know, I come out of it sane on the other end? And he said it was still the most important time of his life. He said seeing what it's like to be in jail, experiencing what that's like. He says even if just feeling better now that I don't drink anymore, not only enjoying life and having a smile on my face since I'm no longer polluting myself, if that weren't enough, just the fact that I'm enjoying myself, I have a wonderful relationship with a young woman at this point and is doing well in life. So if that weren't enough, just the thought that if I slip up, I would end up back in that place. He says that's all the motivation that I need for the rest of my life. That would have been good for Mr. Winston to experience that, to know that's what happens to you if you sexually assault young women, if you shoplift. That's what happens. Change the subject here, but talking about the violence of Islam as we did earlier in the program, another 37 people were murdered. Twice that many were mutilated in cities across Syria. Yesterday, particularly in the Syrian city of Homs. Boy, it is, you see pictures of that place, and it's as you would expect hell to be. Now, hell is not a physical place, but oh my God, it is just so revolting. The rebels that America is providing weapons to used a car bomb and suicide bombers to kill these people. They also used mortars that America had provided to kill and wound 14 more and wound 80. They used the mortars to attack a technical institute in central Damascus. Yes, the allies, America's beneficiaries in the Syrian war are reprehensible. I'd like to spend a little more time on the subject we raised yesterday, speaking of reprehensible, where Secretary of State said of the United States at a meeting of the Trilateral Commission. You know, you typically don't hear that name, Trilateral Commission, apart from conspiracy advocates. But there really is a Trilateral Commission, and it is comprised of leaders from a variety of, and leaders, not just political leaders, but also economic leaders, also religious leaders. Many are military leaders, but there is a trilateral commission that does meet, does try to influence world politics, and John Kerry was at a meeting of the Trilateral Commission. And that's where he said that if Israel does not make peace, which means if Israel does not capitulate to those that are warring with it, now, which is just really weird, if Israel does not make peace, it will soon become an apartheid state. Israel isn't the aggressor. You know, when you tell somebody if you don't make peace, then the presumption there is that they're the one who is the aggressor, and that they need to stop being the aggressor and start being peaceful. But that's not the case with Israel. No. Each time that they have been fired upon, they took a defensive posture. They're not going out and trying to do away with Syria and Jordan and Lebanon and Saudi Arabia or Iraq or Iran or Turkey or Egypt. It's Egypt, Turkey, Syria, Lebanon, Jordan, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, Iran that want to do away with Israel. The Israelis didn't go to the Palestinians and say, you know, we're going to start a war against you and kill you. No, they, when Israel was formed, they said, we want you to be citizens. Live with us. The Israelis didn't call the Intifada, which was the uprising. It was called and perpetrated, initiated, and promoted by the Muslims. Israelis don't commit terrorist acts against Arabs, but it is Arab Muslims that are committing the terrorist acts against Israelis. You can't phrase the issue, and framing an issue is really important. You cannot frame the issue as if Israel does not make peace soon. You know, when you have an aggressor that's trying to destroy you and kill you, the option for peace is not in your hands. You can't make peace under those circumstances unless you engage in war against them and obliterate them. And at that point, I guess you've made peace, but that's not what they're talking about here. So the very way the issue is framed shows you the jaundiced nature, the immoral nature, the irrational nature, the ignorant nature of American politics vis-a-vis Israel. And then to say it could become an apartheid state like the old South Africa is stunningly inappropriate. You know, in Israel, the Muslims living there vote. They not only vote, which didn't happen in South Africa, they have full access to Israeli education, health care, economic advancement. They're not treated like second-class citizens. Now, you might say, okay, that's true. So, well, that's what we're calling Israel now. And so in Israel, it's the opposite of that. Now, if you're a Jew in any one of the surrounding Islamic states, you have no rights. You are treated worse than the Republic of South Africa treated the African population. And so there is, it totally does not apply to Israel, totally applies to all of Israel's neighbors in terms of the Muslim countries, to use apartheid. So then the politicians who want to promote their jaundiced view, like Jimmy Carter was one of the first to do this, will say, well, the Israeli behavior in the occupied West Bank is indicative of this. But it's not either. I mean, the most aggressive things Israelis do in the West Bank, which, by the way, was part of Israel, should be part of Israel, was part of God's gift to Israel, and that was incorporated back into Israel when the Muslims who tried to eliminate Israel lost all three wars they perpetrated against Israel. You know, if the West Bank can be incorporated into Israel as a result of Israel defending itself in war, then the United States needs to give up Florida. It needs to give up Texas, New Mexico, Arizona, California, Utah, all of it. It needs to give up Hawaii. So, you know, this righteous indignation is just completely misplaced in this regard. But what are the Israelis doing in the West Bank that has America and the rest of the world so irritated? They're building homes. What else are they doing? They're building factories. What else are they doing? They're raising crops. When they build those factories and raise those crops, who do they employ? Muslims. Give them a far better work opportunity and wage by a gargantuan amount than they could earn anyplace else. They provide them with health care. They don't say, you know, we're going to build this factory, we're going to build this farm, and the only people that can work in the farm and factory are Jews, and big sign outside that says no Muslim allowed. No. In fact, the biggest of those employs many thousands of Arab Muslims. And so when you accuse one side of saying you have done something that is horrendous and working against peace because you built homes, you built factories, you've employed the very people that they're being accused of treating in an apartheid fashion, you're growing food, and that's unacceptable. What's acceptable to these political misguided individuals in America and throughout Europe and throughout the Islamic world is to have a dependent Muslim population that they can manipulate and control, and to have Israel so vulnerable that the state is destroyed because they're anti-Semites. That was what was exposed by John Kerry's comments. That's why he ought to resign. And if he doesn't resign, he ought to be fired. Personally, I'm appreciative of the fact that he said it, because it cratered what was left of his peace plan. It is truly amazing that the news has been so preoccupied with Donald Sterling saying something that at the very worst could and might have at some time precluded an African-American from getting a free seat to a basketball game to sit next to him. Yet you don't hear the public outcry in the media against John Kerry that made a statement that has the very stake of Israel hanging in the balance, showing that the United States publicly now views Israel as an apartheid state, that America views Israel as the one that is promoting the fighting in their country as opposed to defending themselves against the terrorists. One is, on a 1 to 10 scale of importance, is a 10. Because the next world war is, if Obama doesn't get his way in the Ukraine, is going to be fought with Muslims attacking Israel, with wielding American weapons, and because America made Israel vulnerable by forcing it to give up the West Bank. And since there really is a God, and since he cares a lot about Israel, that's a really bad position for America to put itself in. On a 1 to 10 scale of importance, politically, from a violence point of view, from a war point of view, Kerry's statements are a 10 on the Richter scale of wow, that was unacceptable, inaccurate, and should not be condoned. And yet he still is the Secretary of State of the United States. He wasn't fired. He wasn't getting a $2.5 million penalty. He wasn't banned from participation in any aspect of the U.S. government for life. No, he's given a pass. Wow. Some country we have, huh? Now, Kerry, his comment was not only a controversial comment on the Middle East, on the Muslim world, that Kerry made during his remarks to the Trilateral Commission, a recording of which was obtained by the Daily Beast. Kerry also, by the way, so you have two people, by the way, that were recorded. One was recorded illegally. I'm not sure that recording even a private meeting, because if you're making a statement to world leaders as part of an event like this, then I don't think recording is illegal. I know for certain that recording is illegal in the case of Donald Sterling when he was recorded by his, girlfriend. So he was recorded. A recording surfaced. It was promoted by the Daily Beast. Wasn't on TMZ, mind you. Maybe too liberal for TMZ to go after. So TMZ will out a racist, but won't out an anti-Semite. That's interesting. But you know, that's not totally true, because I think they also outed a couple of anti-Semitic rants by Hollywood actors, just not a politician. Kerry also repeated his warning that a failure of Middle East peace talks could lead to a resumption of Palestinian violence against Israeli citizens. In fact, he actually encouraged it. He just said, you know, that people are going to get so frustrated that they aren't given what they think they deserve, that they will naturally be prone to violence. And he was actually providing a justification for Arab Muslims living in and around Israel to go kill Jews and say, you're justified in doing it. And he wasn't fired for that. He wasn't given a lifetime ban for that. He wasn't fined for that statement. Didn't even apologize for it. He suggested that a change in either Israel or the Palestinian leadership could make achieving a peace deal more feasible. In other words, now he wants to intervene. And affairs that are not his to intervene in. That's what our CIA and our State Department have done for years, intervened in internal politics. America's CIA and State Department intervened in the Ukrainian politics, which caused the junta that now runs the Ukraine. All this mess was created because we intervened. We meddled in their politics because we wanted a different leader. The United States did. Now the United States wants a different leader in Israel. And so it's meddling again. And this idea that a different leader in either the Palestinian or Israeli side, that's nonsense. Because he knows that any leader on the Palestinian side that's actually elected, that actually has the authority to make an agreement, will be far more of a fundamentalist, will be a Hamas representative. So he's speaking of interfering in Israel. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. We're going to interrupt our coverage of the anti-Semite John Kerry to go to line one. We've got Bubba J calling in from the next track on the NASCAR series, sitting on top of a case of a beer, complaining about the fact that his life was ruined because he was a first grade dropout. Bubba, how you doing today?
Well, yeah, it's all about semantics there, Yada. You know, when they tell you, you know, they told me, these people tell me, I'm telling you, they held me back. I didn't flunk, they held me back. Okay?
The fact that you robbed a beer truck, in your youth, that had nothing to do with your situation?
No, nothing at all. Not in first grade, it didn't.
Not in first grade. You didn't have an alcohol problem in first grade?
No.
Okay, well, that's good. Hello, Larry. Welcome. I guess I could poke fun with you since that is sort of how you introduced yourself.
Well, I thought that was pretty good. You were pounding on me pretty hard there.
You have in all seriousness here, Bubba J. Do you have a take on Kerry? Do you think that he ought to be representing the United States State Department?
I think John Kerry represents the elite who no longer represent the United States, and of course he shouldn't. You know, he's going to do nothing but bring about bad things that are going to be heaped upon this country, according to Yahweh.
Yeah, thank you for slamming me here, and you would have had every opportunity to do so, because he made all four of these derogatory comments, inaccurate comments, immoral comments, irrational comments against Israel at the Trilateral Commission.
Just imagine that.
Yeah, it's pretty hard to say, all right, there aren't people that are scheming against our interests as elitists who are part of a trilateral commission that has Israel in its crosshairs, because the trilateralists are going to be aligned with the beast, a.k.a. Satan, and therefore they will be opposed to that which Yahweh loves and respects, which would be Israel. So at this point, if you were to view the Trilateral Commission as representing the beast and being opposed to God, that would be a case that I would have a very difficult time refuting.
Well, that would be the case I'd make. I mean, I'm just looking at his words, and Yahweh pretty much breaks it down, and they will have a one-world government, and they'll all go attack Israel, won't they? I mean, that's what it comes to.
Yeah, probably the only difference here, and I'm actually weakening my own position, but I recognize that there are international bankers, that there are international merchants, that there are international politicians, that there are international military leaders, international religious leaders, that collectively have an agenda, which is to empower themselves and to make the world more universally under their influence, and that they seek to accomplish that, and that their primary enemy are those who know and love Yahweh, or even those who live in the Promised Land. They view God as their enemy. And that they will collectively align themselves with the leader in Macedonia that will be demon-possessed and will present himself as the Torahless one. I fully acknowledge all that, because that's all predicted. God has never been wrong in his testimony, and that's what he said was going to happen. What is interesting about these trilateralists is that in the Daniel testimony, regarding the foul nature of this beast, who I think is going to be, based upon what you read, what I read there, is going to be not only a Macedonian, I know he's going to be a Macedonian, but I think also an Orthodox Christian, growing out of the Eastern Orthodox history that was established by Constantine, that the first thing he's going to do, and God's very specific, that he's going to use economics to rise to power. Daniel's explicit in that regard. But the other thing he's going to do is, as soon as he has achieved his power base economically by manipulating currencies, that he's going to ravage those who aligned with him to bring him to power. So these trilateralists can all see that you can't trust Satan. You imagine that.
You get in bed with dogs, you get fleas.
Imagine that. You can't trust Satan. Who would have ever suspected that would have been the case? But, that's what God says. The first thing that the guy does once he rises to worldwide influence economically, manipulating things economically, that he turns on those that had aligned with him to bring him to power.
I know, it's unbelievable that anybody would think they could deal, you know, with him on some level. It's unbelievable to me.
Yeah, it's particularly remarkable considering that those who would be part of a commission like the Trilaterals Commission think of themselves to be enlightened. They think themselves to be empowered. They think themselves to be superior to ordinary people and deserving of more influence in the world. And yet they're going to be played for fools. I mean, literally, they're going to be played for fools.
That anybody could think they could take the side. I know they sing songs about Lucifer, you know, and we all know who that is. I mean, it's just another word for Halal Ben Shikar, another name.
Right.
And how in the world would you think you could get that with Satan and come out on top? You know?
Yeah.
I mean, he's going to, if you know his nature is to make you lose. That's what he's about.
Well, what's, of course, amazing about the whole thing, too, Satan doesn't want to be worshipped as Satan. He doesn't want to be known as Satan. That's one of the things that fools people the most, is they can't imagine that Islam and Christianity are satanic, because they thought that in a satanic occultist religion, then they would be overtly acknowledging Satan. But that's not what the devil wants. That's not what he wants to achieve. He wants to be worshipped as God. Which means in every one of his religions,
apparently, and that's done through all religion, but the trilateralists openly do it. It's just the weirdest thing.
Well, yeah, so do the Freemasons when they reach the highest level, and when they become Shriners. It's open acknowledgement.
Involved in that movement, I believe.
Of course, yeah. So was Bill Clinton. So was Ronald Reagan. They all were. But the reality is that when you see Satan being openly acknowledged, that's not something that Satan is promoting. He is absolutely has no interest with being openly acknowledged. He does not want to be known as the adversary. He wants to be known as God. That's why he loves the title Lord.
Why he loves religion.
That's why.
Religious copy edits that take Yahweh's nature and have him commanding us to do things all the time.
That's why removing Yahweh's name from his Torah, prophets, and Psalms and replacing it with Satan's name was the single most egregious act that's ever been perpetrated in the history of mankind. Because what it did is it fooled people into replacing Yahweh with Satan in the very words that Yahweh himself prescribed.
You have
a horrible situation. And now you have the people who are advocating these sorts of things, positioning Israel in a way that is the antithesis of reality. One of the things that I learned a long time ago, mainly because I loved debate as a young man, and I don't like debate anymore. But I loved debate. I traveled throughout the state at the time I was growing up, and loved to debate. My best skill was extemporaneous and impromptu speaking, but debate was my love. It was a real passion for me, and the reason I gave it up is that in competing in debate, you have to be willing to have a coin flip as to what side of an argument that
you don't have to believe in what you're debating.
Right.
In competitive debate.
Right. In competitive debate, it's a coin flip as to what side of the argument that you're going to have. And there was something in me that said, that's not right. You ought to be using your rhetoric to support that which you know to be true. You ought to be going where the words lead. You ought not be parceling down the evidence so only those things that support your view are presented, and they're shaded in such a way that gives an impression that you're right and you ignore evidence that indicates you're wrong. So there's a compulsion part of me that just conviction that wasn't right in all that.
Yeah, well, but they were training people to go up there and just to advance whatever notions they work for advanced.
And so Bubba, as I was practicing debate, one of the things I learned is that if you frame the issue correctly, it's impossible for the person who is debating against you to prevail, even if all of the evidence is on their side. It's about framing the issue. And so what Kerry is doing here, the Trilateral Commission here is doing, is framing the issue. They're framing the issue that Israel's the aggressor. They're framing the issue that Israel is the one that doesn't want to make peace. They're framing the issue that Israel is the impediment to peace by building homes. They're framing the issue, right, that they're imposing this horrible circumstance on the victims. And part of the myth, of course, that by framing the issue is that they're really is a people called Palestinians, which there isn't, and a state that should be called Palestine, which there has never been.
Can I throw something in here? This is kind of an interesting thing to me. I read where Samuel Clemens had visited Israel, you know, prior to World War II, obviously, and he was, you know, they were traveling in a wagon, a horse-driven wagon. And he says, is this the country we hear so much about? He was really blown away because they would literally travel for days and see, according to him, nobody.
Now,
if that's the case, you have to ask where all these people came from and why they came.
That was in the late 1800s, early 1900s.
Yeah, that's right.
Early 1900s. Yeah, and nobody there. So I mean, it's this whole myth that that Israel was horrible and pushed people out of their homes is again part of framing the issue. Israel said, no, everyone that is there now stay. We'll be partakers with us. We'll make this land bloom. You'll be full citizens. The only reason that any of them left was because the Arabs said, get out of the way so we can kill Jews. So here we have the Secretary of State of the United States framing the issue with the Trilateral Commission against Israel. He's stated that it's Israel that is the one unwilling to make peace, which means that Israel is the one who is the aggressor, as opposed to Israel defending itself against Islamic aggression. He has presented Israel as the apartheid state, the country that is repressing the rights of minorities, as opposed to the state that treats the minority population vastly better than any of the 50 Islamic states surrounding it. He has positioned building of houses as a crime against humanity. He has positioned a fictitious people and a fictitious place as the solution for this problem, rendering Israel indefensible by thinning the nation as the at the waist as the only solution. And then he's gone so far as to say that if Israel doesn't capitulate to everything that he's demanding, then it will stir the righteous indignation of these mythical people who will then begin to terrorize the Jews and do so justifiably. Glenn has called in and joined the program. Glenn, do you have any issue with either Secretary of State Kerry, Bubba Jay here sitting at the NASCAR event, or myself?
Actually, it was the debate thing that piqued my interest.
You're a lover of debate.
Absolutely.
You know,
you know all the fallacies.
You can even cite the fallacies in Latin. When you can cite debate fallacies in Latin, you are an aficionado of rhetoric.
Yes, pros hoc ergo propter hoc. Oh, makes me
feel good. Okay. I'm impressed. All right.
And
speak English, please.
No, the purpose of the usefulness of you're deliberately playing the role of the contrarian. It can be very helpful in testing a given teaching or doctrine or and also like it helps people develop their skills and that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
I often think back that I know without addressing the validity or horrific nature of the Catholic Church in the Middle Ages, the Catholics in their debates would have a priest dress up as the devil to be the contrarian in debates to test the supposed soundness of a given doctrine. you know, in playing that role. And I understand your discomfort with flipping the coin and taking the side you don't like, but we'd all rather argue from our passion.
Right. Yes, yeah. it's just that all people aren't made the same, and I am a very passionate individual, and I really like to align myself with that which I know to be true, right and good, and to promote what I know to be right, true, and good. And I'm not even willing now to align myself with those who are opposed to something I opposed, because I find that I am just steadfast in, you only need to ally yourself with that which you know is right, truthful, and good. And so I'm really careful in this area. I will tell you, Glenn, though, to your credit, that by engaging in so many debates, I did learn how to properly wield evidence to make a point, and I learned that in a debate, for example, and this really helped me in writing both Prophet of Doom and Questioning Paul, that in a debate, if you state 10 reasons that your position is true and your opponent's position is false, what will happen in a debate is that your opponent will ignore your strongest 8 issues, the ones that they would have the most difficulty refuting. And they will focus on your 2 weakest points. And if they can chip away at those 2 weakest points, you can lose a debate when 80% of the evidence supports your side. And so one of the things I learned to do is to be really careful at the points that I would raise in an argument, that if there were 10 points that I could use, but 5 of them were irrefutable, I'd only wield the 5.
Right, right. And that's right. And that's because to do what you're describing is somewhat disingenuous. And there's a big difference between, like, debating in good faith with sound logic versus what we have going on today with these word weasels and spin doctors. They're just irreprehensible.
Oh, of course. Well, I would go as far as to say that what we are witnessing when we hear about presidential debates and the like, that they aren't debates. There are no rules of debate that are being applied to them. And there isn't a winner and loser based upon evidence and reason, but instead purely on style. We'll be back after the break.